What happens when you reach the top of the ladder only to realize it's been leaning against the wrong wall all along? This wasn't a hypothetical question for Clayton Christensen, the Harvard professor who revolutionized how we think about innovation. When cancer, the same disease that took his father, knocked on his door, suddenly all those business theories felt hollow. Here was a man who taught CEOs and presidents how to disrupt markets, now facing the ultimate disruption, a life potentially cut short before he'd answered the questions that actually mattered. His response wasn't to write another business book. Instead, he turned his analytical lens inward, asking, "How can I find happiness in my career? How can I ensure my relationships become enduring sources of joy? How can I live with integrity?" What emerged was a framework so powerful that when Tim Cook was asked which book most influenced him, he named this one. These aren't just philosophical musings. They're practical theories tested across thousands of lives, offering a roadmap for measuring what truly counts. We're drowning in advice. Self-help gurus promise 5 easy steps to happiness. LinkedIn influencers sell morning routines. Everyone has an opinion about how you should live. But here's the problem. Advice based on someone else's experience rarely fits your unique circumstances. What if instead of being told what to think, you learned how to think? When Andy Grove, Intel's legendary CEO, invited Christensen to explain his research in 1997, something remarkable happened. Christensen didn't prescribe what Intel should do about emerging competition. Instead, he taught Grove how to think by explaining the theory of disruption through the steel industry's transformation. Grove later said this approach was invaluable. "I don't want you to tell me what to think, I want you to tell me how to think." Years later, when Christensen presented the same theories to the Department of Defense about combating terrorism, the framework proved equally powerful despite the wildly different context. That's the magic of good theory. It transcends specific situations. Think about early attempts at human flight. Inventors obsessed over wings and feathers because birds had them. Pure correlation. The breakthrough came only when we understood Bernoulli's principle, the actual cause of lift. Similarly, we often pursue life strategies based on superficial patterns rather than understanding what truly causes fulfillment. Good theory offers if-then statements that help you predict outcomes before experiencing them, crucial when learning through trial and error is too costly. In life, you can't A/B test your marriage or rewind your children's childhoods. This is where theory becomes your most valuable asset, helping you make better decisions the first time around. Most companies treat motivation transactionally, believing good pay ensures performance. Frederick Hertzberg's research reveals otherwise. Compensation doesn't create job satisfaction, it merely prevents dissatisfaction. Hygiene factors like salary, status, and security can make you miserable if inadequate, but improving them beyond baseline won't make you love your work. True motivators are entirely different: challenging work, recognition, responsibility, and personal growth. This explains why nonprofit workers often report deep satisfaction despite modest pay, while highly compensated professionals feel empty and trapped. Many chase hygiene factors, then expand lifestyles to match salaries, creating golden handcuffs. Finding fulfilling work requires balancing deliberate planning with seizing unexpected opportunities. Honda's American Motorcycle entry illustrates this perfectly. Their strategy to compete with large bikes flopped. Meanwhile, employees rode small Super Cubs recreationally in Los Angeles, and curious onlookers kept asking where to buy them. This accidental discovery, completely outside their deliberate strategy, led to market dominance. If you've found work providing both hygiene factors and genuine motivators, deliberate planning makes sense. If not, an emergent strategy, experimenting, learning, iterating quickly, serves you better. Christensen dreamed of editing the Wall Street Journal, but pivoted when consulting opportunities appeared. His career emerged through adaptation, not prediction. When evaluating opportunities, focus less on projections and more on identifying assumptions that must prove true for success. Test your most critical assumptions swiftly to avoid climbing ladders leaning against the wrong walls. Your real strategy isn't what you say, it's how you spend your time, energy, and money. Sonosight created revolutionary handheld ultrasound equipment, but CEO Kevin Goodwin couldn't convince their top salesperson to demonstrate the strategically important iLook device instead of the larger, more profitable Titan. Commission structures drove behavior, revealing a fundamental truth. Resource allocation is where strategy moves from words to reality. Apple in the 1990s nearly died from this disconnect. When Jobs returned in 1997, he didn't just change the strategy document, he changed where people actually spent their time. Most companies' decision-making systems naturally steer investments toward immediate returns while starving long-term success. Your personal resource allocation works identically. High achievers unconsciously direct resources toward activities yielding immediate, tangible accomplishments, typically their careers, while neglecting relationships that don't provide that same dopamine hit of visible progress. Your strategy emerges through hundreds of everyday decisions, written not in mission statements, but in calendar entries and credit card statements. The questions worth asking aren't about salary or title, but whether your work offers opportunities to learn, achieve, take responsibility, and make meaningful contributions, where your actual resource allocation must align if you want to build a life that matters. Your deepest joy comes from intimate relationships with family and close friends, yet these require consistent investment precisely when they seem least urgent. Many professionals believe they can sequence life investments, career now, family later. This strategy fails because critical investments in children must be made early, during narrow windows that never reopen. Research by Risley and Hart reveals that in the first 30 months of life, children of talkative parents hear 48 million words versus just 13 million for children of less verbal parents. These early language-dancing interactions create neural pathways affecting cognitive development for years. You can't make up this investment later. The window closes. Understanding what job you're hired to do in relationships yields enormous payoff. Scott came home to find his exhausted wife, Barbara, collapsed on the couch. He immediately started cleaning and cooking, thinking he was being helpful. But Barbara didn't need a housekeeper. She needed adult conversation after a day with demanding toddlers. We constantly give our spouses what we think they should want rather than what they actually need. The path to happiness isn't finding someone who makes you happy, but finding someone whose happiness is worth devoting yourself to. Sacrifice deepens commitment. Christensen's daughter Annie developed deep love for Mongolia precisely because her missionary work there was so difficult. Two forces work against relationship investment: the temptation to invest elsewhere for immediate payoff, and the fact that family rarely demands your attention loudly. If you defer investing until you think you need to, it will be too late. You can't outsource this presence, and the window closes faster than you think. Today's parents obsess over creating opportunities: private coaches, enrichment programs, tutors for every subject. Yet this well-intentioned approach often backfires, mirroring Dell's experience with Asus. Dell outsourced component manufacturing to Asus for cost savings. Step by step, Asus took on more: motherboards, graphics cards, assembly, entire computers. By 2005, Asus had learned everything and launched its own competing brand. Dell had outsourced not just components, but its future capabilities. Capabilities fall into three categories: resources, tangible assets like people and cash; processes, how employees transform resources into products; and priorities, how decisions get made. A child's resources include time, knowledge, and relationships. Processes are what children do with those resources, how they think, solve problems, and work with others. Priorities determine how they make decisions. When we hire tutors and coaches to handle every challenge, we deny children the chance to build essential capabilities. Self-esteem comes from achieving something difficult when it matters. By outsourcing household responsibilities and replacing them with enrichment activities where children are merely passengers, We've created a generation lacking the processes that translate into employment and fulfillment. Christensen's mother showed him once how to mend his clothes, then let him figure it out. The pride he felt built capability and confidence, far more valuable than having someone do it for him.
Traditional talent identification fails spectacularly. Companies seek candidates with innate talents evidenced by consistent success, yet executives with stellar track records frequently fail in new companies. Managers report a 25% failure rate. The problem? Looking for correlated skills rather than causal experience. Success comes from capabilities built through experience, not innate talent. Nolan Archibald deliberately built his career by selecting jobs based on the experiences they would provide, including working in an asbestos mine in northern Quebec to gain leadership experience in difficult conditions. These strategic decisions helped him become the youngest ever CEO of a Fortune 500 company at 42. Parents should consciously engineer experiences that develop necessary capabilities. Christensen shares how a friend worked with a teacher to create a gentle but embarrassing moment for her 8-year-old who had plagiarized a book report. This early experience with appropriate consequences was valuable precisely because stakes were low. Better to learn this lesson at 8 than at 18. When children fail at something difficult, help them learn that failure is part of aiming high. Let them experience consequences rather than building false self-esteem. You can't teach resilience through lectures or buy grit with enrichment programs. Character emerges from wrestling with real challenges at the right developmental moments. Peter Drucker observed that inadequate thought about purpose is the most important cause of frustration and failure. A useful purpose needs three components: a likeness of what you want to become, deep commitment to creating this likeness, and metrics to measure progress. For Christensen, his likeness emerged from family, faith, and profession. A man dedicated to improving others' lives, a kind and honest husband and father, someone who truly believes in God. Intensive prayer at Oxford transformed this aspiration into unshakable commitment. Understanding how his life would be measured took longest. After being passed over for a church assignment, a 2-month crisis revealed crucial insight. The true measure wouldn't be positions or money, but individuals helped one by one. When a stroke left him barely able to speak, he chose to help others rather than retreat inward, a choice that restored his happiness. Discovering your life's purpose will be the most important thing you learn. Without clarity, you'll climb ladders only to find they've leaned against wrong walls. The theories in this book gain full power only when guided by clear purpose, your North Star for the thousands of small decisions that define who you become.